From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. The American Testing Program, based in Iowa City, known nationwide by its acronym ACT, has marked its 50th anniversary. This hour, we look back at the founding of ACT, which specializes in education and workforce development, with its CEO and chairman, Dick Ferguson. I'll also be joined by Mark Harding and Phil Caffrey of admissions at Iowa State University. We'll look at how the development of testing theory has changed over time and what role such testing plays in getting into a desired college. That's all coming up, but first, a look at this hour's news. And this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A new exhibit at the State Historical Museum showcases the 50-year history of ACT, Inc., the Iowa City-based not-for-profit organization specializing in education and workforce development. ACT, 50 years, 1959-2009, is on display through May of 2010, at the State Historical Museum in Des Moines. The exhibit traces the history of ACT, Inc., originally known as the American College Testing Program. So this hour, we want to take a look back at the history of ACT, and it comes at a time when how those tests are used for college admission is changing. Joining me, first of all, for this hour, the CEO and chairman of ACT, Dick Ferguson. Thank you for joining us today.
Very welcome.
Tell us about the founding of ACT. Take us back to 1959. Why did it happen? Where did it happen? Who was involved?
As you know, Ben, the roots of ACT are found in individuals who actually have been identified and were identified with the University of Iowa at the time. On those particular years, those early years, there was but one college admission assessment, the SAT, which came out of the East Coast and was fundamentally a product designed, developed for the more elite institutions, the Ivy Leagues. And there the agenda and the interest was largely in identifying the most talented youth and essentially admitting them to college and not too much concern for those who were not in that particular group. The founders of ACT, both of them University of Iowa faculty and staff members, had a different view of the world, and that was that college could be for larger numbers of individuals and that the aim ought to be helping those individuals understand what the skills are that they need in order to be successful once admitted to college. And that came in part out of the public university perspective that they brought from the University of Iowa and their experience around the country. So the ACT program was essentially created when it was clear that the other exam was not going to serve that particular mission, mm-hmm. the concern of getting much larger numbers of students ready for post-secondary education.
So who were the figures involved, the leading figures in the founding of ACT?
Probably the more prominent of the two, but both were well-known in their own circles, was E.F. Lindquist. Lindquist was, among other things, the founder of the Iowa testing programs, which continue to operate through the University of Iowa. Also was the inventor, an engineer by training as well, of the optical scan scoring machine, which ultimately revolutionized testing in the sense that it allowed for much larger numbers of individuals to be essentially evaluated and assessed, and that turnaround time increased to where it could be producing useful information in a timely way. The second was Ted McCarroll, who was at the time involved in admissions and was the registrar at the University of Iowa. Ted had a network of friends around the country who were in so many of the universities, in the publics in particular, because he was the head of the National Association of College Admissions Officers and Registrars. So the two of them together made a wonderful team in getting ACT off the ground.
Mm-hmm. So it was because of these individuals. If I ask why Iowa City, why the University of Iowa, we point back to those individuals. Why not another large university?
Absolutely. In fact, in the very early years, ACT was offered property to locate in the greater Denver area. And the connections and the ties to the university and the Iowa City area were very, very strong. And, of course, that story now has played out. 50 years later, we remain here and are a very, very large employer in the area.
Mm-hmm. Looking back to back 50 years over these five decades, what would you point to as the major milestones in the development of ACT?
I think one of those is an early recognition on the part of the staff and the board and all the persons who have a role in the direction of ACT, that waiting to a particular point in time, which is when a youngster is about to transition from high school to college, and then to essentially establish that that person does or does not have the skills that has them ready for a successful experience in college was not a good model. And that moved ACT to a point of view that said, well, college admissions is not a point in time. It is a process. And it begins a lot earlier with the decisions that the students, parents, teachers, counselors, others make regarding what does that student actually do? What courses are they taking that is going to prepare them for subsequent education? And so that led to ACT building systems of assessment that are all logically linked and tied together, 8th grade, 10th grade, all tied so that we have an early understanding on the part of the student, the parent, the school, that this is a youngster who is or is not on track, but where there is time to intervene, help them get the skills that they are lacking, in fact, if they are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a problem today, I might add. If you were to look at the roughly well over 1.5 million high school seniors who were tested this last year by ACT around the country, unfortunately, today, there are still substantial numbers of those, on the order of 40% or more, who do not take math and science in their junior and senior year of high school.
And that's reflected in the scores on ACT.
It is reflected in the scores, but it also plays out then in the readiness of those students when they enter college to essentially take that freshman algebra class to be essentially ready for those courses. And we see, of course, many students who do not succeed academically when they get there. And it's a major challenge to provide helpful remediation and correction once the student is already there, which only brings us back to the point that early intervention is the best path to take, getting the youngster, getting the adult, in the case that that may be the instance that we're dealing with of an individual, but starting early so that it's not a particularly rocket science issue here, in the sense that if there are skills that individuals are going to need, and whether it's for college or for a training program or it's for a job, mm-hmm. that knowing what the skills are that will be needed and then having training programs or curricula that are going to help them get that, I think, is certainly key. But then exercising and taking advantage of that is what's very, very critical.
My guest is the CEO and chairman of ACT, Inc., based in Iowa City, celebrating a 50-year history. Then we're looking back this hour at ACT's history and also the development of testing. To what degree does your organization have to react, or does it react, to new initiatives, presidential initiatives, No Child Left Behind or Race to the Top? Does that play a role in your planning, how you approach your business?
Well, it does, and in many, many different ways. But let me speak at least to one that is very much at the core of what is occurring today on the national and on the state scene with respect to the whole question of standards. Because ACT has probably the richest database available in the country regarding what are the skills that our young people need to have if they're going to be successful when they arrive in college, or for that matter, ultimately in a career, but certainly for college, ACT has been literally right in the middle of the national effort underway by the National Governors Association and the Council of Chief State School Officers, all driven by the U.S. Department of Education. So we have been very much at the table in helping to build the initial set of national common standards that are now being vetted and discussed all around the country. But those standards are for college readiness in the language, arts, and math. And they have been developed for the secondary school level. The plan nationally is ultimately to develop those standards across various grade levels and, in course, in more subjects than just math and language arts. But so for us, the fact that we have data that can speak to what are these skills that are required becomes very, very important and critical, as opposed to individuals sitting around the table saying, I think someone's going to need this. I mm-hmm. think they're going to need that.
You have the concrete.
We have hard data, the empirical data that mm-hmm. say this is what we need. And by the way, we know that because we have data on how the students actually perform when they get to college.
A couple minutes before we have to take a short break, I wanted to have you address the other side of ACT. It's more than a college student assessment.
Correct.
You are in workforce assessment, something that maybe a lot of people don't know about because they think of ACT only from their college years or their other student right. years. What is workforce assessment? What are you involved in there?
Well, the work that we do in that area acknowledges that the education that individuals are getting ultimately aims to get them to, for the most part, a productive work environment where they have skills that are needed for the jobs that they want and the jobs that are available to them. So we recognized many years ago that we did have a critical issue in the country. Employers are now seeing that in a very, very real way in that so many instances, we have companies that are having difficulty finding individuals who have the skills, in many cases the degrees and the studies completed that are needed for the jobs that are there. There are a lot of jobs in this country that are going unfilled now because there are people who do not have the skills to essentially satisfy those jobs. So ACT became involved in a very, very big way in developing what we refer to as the WorkKey system, which well known here in the corridor and used by many, many employers, where we identify skills that specific jobs require, assess them, and then facilitate instruction that help individuals to move from one level to the next. Currently, the system that we have developed is being used around the country and with growing interest around the world in it as well. Foundational skills that jobs need and assist them for helping individuals identify what they are and then get them.
Mm-hmm. How do you measure the effectiveness of such a program?
In part, in many, many different ways. Are the training programs that are using them around the country essentially getting individuals prepared for the jobs? Ultimately, the employer is the evaluator there in the sense that if the individual acquires a job, goes to the job, has the skills, the evidence is in. If they don't, obviously, we would have a more serious problem.
Okay, very good. We have to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a moment with more of my conversation with Dick Ferguson, the CEO and chairman of ACT, Inc., based in Iowa City, not-for-profit organization specializing in education and workforce development. There is a ACT 50 years, 59 to 2009. exhibit on display through May of this year at the State Historical Museum in Des Moines. And when we come back, we'll talk about what standardized tests can do well and perhaps what they can't do well and how a standardized test can guard against bias. We'd like to have your input as well. If you have a question or comment for Dick Ferguson, 1-866-780-9100. You could share your ACT experiences. Do you remember taking the test? 1-866-780-9100 or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in 1 minute. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, talking about standardized testing, specifically ACT, Inc., celebrating 50 years, the Iowa City-based not-for-profit organization. Started in 1959, and now it's quite a large organization. People across the country and across the world have heard of ACT. We have ACT, Inc.'s chairman and CEO, Dick Ferguson, with us in the studio for the next 10 minutes, 1-866-780-9100, or theexchange@iowapublicradio.org if you have a question or a comment. Before we do, since 1959, it started out brainchild of a couple people here in Iowa City at the University of Iowa. How large of an organization is ACT now?
Today we have roughly 1,400 staff at any given time. The vast majority of those are located here in Iowa City, but we do have 13 regional offices around the country and then a number of subsidiaries around the world, and they probably totally add another 200 staff to our makeup as an organization at the time.
Let's talk a little bit about testing. What, in your mind, is the best way for ACT scores to be utilized by colleges, for instance?
In the case of most colleges we find around the country, they are regularly used and routinely used for placing individuals into the initial courses that they will take. There's obviously no percentage in having a young person enroll in a freshman math course if they're unprepared for that particular course. So the opportunity to determine whether they are or are not using the ACT score and high school grades, both in combination, enables the institution to say maybe we need to start at a different point. By the same token, there are students who are well advanced and could be, in fact, taking a higher level course if that was the option that was available to them. So placement is very significant, and another part of that is academic advising. Many institutions, many colleges use the program and the information that we gather, which goes well beyond test scores. We collect nearly 200 pieces of information on individuals as they register
For instance, what is this maybe a surprising question
sure.
about an individual that you would ask?
Well, the high school classes they've taken, the grades that they earned in those classes, what they perceive themselves to have as weaknesses and needing help in.
Mm-hmm.
So we ask the students, and they're very honest, and it's very, very interesting to see how many of them will say.
How do you know they're honest?
Because the evidence would be when they actually arrive in college and those needs are there and present, then you have that opportunity to verify and validate it. In fact, students pretty much know if they know if they have a reading problem. They know if their math skills are not quite what they need to be.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not usually too bashful about telling us that. Which is a way of also informing the institution. In some respects, I'm going to need to be ready to help and do some of these things if I want these students to be successful.
What are the areas where you feel ACT may be weaker? Standardized tests in general, what are hard things to evaluate, to measure in an individual by standardized testing?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think is always on the table, and we hear this, of course, quite regularly around the country, been true for the years since optical scan scoring has been available, and that is the notion that one can assess with multiple choice items that essentially are the bubble tests. Can you assess everything that a student needs to know and do that well? Well, the answer, of course, is not. There are many things that you can measure directly with students that you cannot measure with a multiple choice type test. On the other hand, there are also many things that you can measure better with a multiple choice test than you can directly. A student's writing, we ask a student to write an essay, and they can usually write a page in 30 or 40 minutes, which then has to be human scored, and you have no notion of whether or not the writing they did is going to actually provide you a sample of something where you can evaluate, do they have good diction, do they have spelling, do they have no punctuation and grammar. Whereas with a multiple choice test, you can make sure that you are finding that out by virtue of the way you construct the test. So it's not an easy answer. There are not simple formulas here. One is better in some areas than the other.
About 5 minutes left with you. Let's go to a caller, Sammy in Iowa City. Good afternoon.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering about some alternative areas that you guys don't seem to look at in the line of college students. Like, for example, the ability to get over a night of binge drinking and be able to still take your classes?
I'm not sure if that's a serious question there, Sammy. Are you meaning that serious? I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, I think that's an integral part of the college curriculum these days, isn't it?
You may, in fact, be right. Sammy, thank you for that question from Iowa City. I want to ask you, before we have to go, Dick Ferguson, about the studies that have shown that some minority groups don't perform as well as standardized tests like ACT, raising some allegations of bias. How do you guard against bias?
Well, in the first place, it would be maybe useful for the audience to know that we take literally 3 full years to develop one form of the ACT test. And on each test date, there is a new form of the test that is administered. But that 3-year process is required in order for us, one, to ensure the quality of what it is that we are essentially measuring with our test items, but also includes review by virtually all the different minority groups and minority reviewers to ensure that the content is not biased, that we don't have.
Can you give me an example, a concrete example of a question, a type of question that would have been thrown out because it might favor white
Well, you know, one of the traditional case studies of that would be using language like regatta in a particular test item, where it's pretty clear that there would be certain students who would have had an experience familiar with that and most would not. So we just don't do that. We don't go there. We're looking for assessing the underlying skill, not someone's vocabulary at some esoteric level.
Or if they've been in the yacht races lately.
Precisely.
Okay. So can you we have just 3 minutes left. I want to talk about a little bit about the business that has grown up around your business, the business of preparing students for the ACT. Lots of different companies do this. You go online, you look
sure.
for ACT preparation, and you'll see them online. What is the difference between those with genuine accumulated knowledge, valuable knowledge, and those who are simply doing well at cramming for tests?
Right.
How can you separate those two groups? Because one is, to an employer, to an institution of higher education, much more valuable than the other, I would assume.
I think that that is right. There's no question about that. But the separation occurs in the case of the ACT because on each test date, we are, in fact, administering a new test. So the notion of cramming so you could somehow get an answer to the questions that we are essentially assessing you with becomes a very, very difficult thing to do. So we don't see short-term cramming as a very successful strategy for students. If the student has already learned the math skill, let's say solving an equation, and they need a refresher to remind them of how to do it, okay, that short-term study is fine. You haven't learned it. You're not going to be able to cram in answers to what we are assessing because you don't have the underlying skills that you're going to need when you get to college.
Mm-hmm.
And so our view, by the way, is teach for the test at some level because we have essentially identified the skills that the student is going to need when they arrive.
Do you work with any of these test preparation companies? Share any information?
Only at the level of trying our best to make sure they're not misrepresenting what we are testing when they build their assessments and build their books and the like.
As this industry of test preparation developed over the years, I'm wondering if you have to adjust your test because of the intense test preparation that the industry has there out there. Are you looking – is it sort of a move, counter move? You see that they're doing this and you want to accurately reflect the profile of the individual, of that academic student.
The good news is the test preparation industry has had very little to no impact on what we are measuring because we are driven by – the curriculum surveys that we do, that and one that we just released this last week, in fact, that basically show what will those students need as defined by the people who are actually teaching those classes in the colleges when they arrive as freshmen. And so what we are measuring is what we know the student will need to actually possess in the way of skill set when they get there. From the point of view of the test prep, if the test prep is really deep and serious, it's actually helping the student, and it's not a bad thing.
Okay, very good. We have to leave it there. Thank you very much for this conversation, CEO and Chairman of ACT Inc., Dick Ferguson. It's been a pleasure having you. Congratulations on 50 years. Of those 50 years, 38 you've been at ACT Inc.
That's right.
And since 1988, CEO and Chairman. Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you, Ben.
When we come back, Mark Harding and Phil Caffrey of admissions at Iowa State University will talk about the use of standardized testing, how it's used in college. When we come back, this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Welcome back to The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It causes lung cancer in tens of thousands of people each year. It's not smoking. It's colorless, odorless, and occurs naturally in most of our homes in Iowa. Radon. Tomorrow on the program, we discuss the dangers of radon, how to test for it in your home, and how to get rid of it during Radon Action Month. That's tomorrow during The Exchange. Today, we're looking at standardized testing, the American testing program based in Iowa City, known nationwide and worldwide by its acronym ACT, has marked its 50th anniversary. ACT 50 years, 1959 to 2009, is on display through May of this year at the State Historical Museum in Des Moines. The exhibit traces the history of ACT, Inc., originally known as the American College Testing Program. This hour, we've been looking back at the history of ACT at a time when how those tests are used for college's mission is changing. In our first half hour, perhaps you were here to hear the conversation with the CEO and chairman of ACT, Inc., Dick Ferguson. Joining me now from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Ames, Mark Harding, Director of Admissions for Iowa State University, and Phil Caffrey, Senior Associate Director of Admissions at ISU. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Great to have you both with us. All four-year colleges and universities in the U.S. accept ACT, but different institutions place different emphases on standardized tests, such as ACT, compared with other factors of evaluation, such as class rank, the GPA, and other extracurricular activities. How does Iowa State University use ACT for college admissions?
Well, we use it primarily for two reasons. It is part of the admissions process for students. We have a new way of admitting students to all three of the public universities called the Region Admission Index, or the RAI for short. And the RAI is simply a mathematical equation where we assign an RAI score to every student who applies for admission. The ACT is one of the four factors that makes up the RAI. So it is a very important part of the admissions decision. But the test scores are also used for placement purposes here at Iowa State. So,
In terms of admission, when you adopted this new system, took on this new system, did it make ACT or SAT more important or less important in the grand scheme for each individual student?
Well, I don't know that I'd say it's any more or less important. From 1958 up until 2008, in other words, for the last 50 years or so, admission to the three public universities was based primarily on class rank, and if students ranked in the top half of their class, they were automatically admissible. If the students weren't in the top half of their class, then they would need to earn a certain score on the ACT or SAT to be admissible. Now, under the Region Admission Index system, the ACT is still an important part, but it's one of four factors rather than maybe one of two factors.
Is this RAI wider, more widely used than just at ISU? Is it an attempt to sort of standardize the way admissions are looked at in major universities?
Well, it's specific to the three public universities here in Iowa.
So Iowa State, University of Northern Iowa, and the University of Iowa all use the same system, this Regents Admissions Index, and all three were involved with the Board of Regents, actually, and other representatives of the state to develop a formula that would really promote, actually, it promotes curriculum choice. It promotes students taking, making better choices in high school. But Iowans should be very proud of the fact that the public universities came together and came up with a system that we think is fair and is very transparent to Iowans. It's anyone can go out there and take a look at what you need to be admissible and calculate your score.
Mm-hmm. What is this new system? How is it set apart from other admissions systems across the United States in other major universities, public universities?
Well, I think maybe one thing that makes the three public universities in Iowa more the exception than the norm is that, as Mark was saying earlier, the admission requirements are very transparent. At most colleges and universities, it's kind of hard to find out exactly what you have to achieve in order to be admissible. Many universities, they just simply look at their pool of applicants and then they choose from among that pool. We operate on a rolling admissions basis at Iowa State, as do our other two regent counterparts. And if a student meets the threshold for admission, they're admitted. It's that simple. And as Mark was saying, students can see before they even apply for admission if they will meet that threshold. And that's one of the reasons why we may not deny as many students as some other colleges and universities, because the students who are not admissible will self-select themselves out of the process to begin with.
Talking with Mark Harding and Phil Caffrey of admissions at Iowa State University, if you have a question or a comment about admissions to the public universities, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. 9100 or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. So this system has been in place in the last 3 years. Before that, how have college admissions requirements, evaluation, placement evolved?
Well, as I was mentioning earlier, back in 1958, the Iowa legislature decided that there ought to be certain standards for admission to the three public universities, and they decided that class rank would be the primary criterion for admission. And they simply said that any Iowa resident who ranks in the top half of their graduating class shall be automatically admissible to any of the three state universities. In the year 2006, I think it was, the Iowa legislature passed a bill requiring the Board of Regents to conduct a study to re-examine the way that we're admitting new freshmen to the university, to see if there's a more effective and maybe a more fair way of making admissions decisions. While class rank is an excellent predictor of success, there are many occasions when it's not always a fair predictor.
Mm-hmm. Were there cases you can recall? Was this driven by student complaints, parent complaints? What was driving this change?
Well, I think there are a number of factors driving that change, including, and I think the most important factor, is an interest, and it's been in the news lately, rigor. It's the whole business of making sure that students are taking the right courses to be successful in college. I think that's probably the number one goal behind this. The fact that you can go online and calculate your score, for example, if you went out to the website and checked this out, you can come up with what your index is currently based upon the courses you're taking in high school. Parents can do this. Counselors can do this. And that you can see that by taking more classes, you can positively affect your score. So you can raise your score by taking more classes. As Phil was explaining earlier, the factor that matters most in the Regents, the RAI process are the courses, the number of courses students take in the core curriculum areas: English, math, science, social science, foreign language.
Mm-hmm. So just if I'm understanding this correctly, mm-hmm. So a student in high school may take, you know, average courses, relatively average courses, and get a 4.0. Another student may take more of the advanced courses and not get a 4.0, and that is considered in this equation.
Exactly. As Mark was saying, the Region Admission Index, for the first time, it provides students with a real incentive to take more rigorous courses. Up until these new requirements were implemented, there was almost an incentive for students to maybe take it easy a little bit during mm-hmm. their senior year because, you know, they have a real high class rank and they realize if they take physics and that fourth year of math and the fourth year of Spanish that there's a good chance that they might not earn quite as good a grades and their rank will drop. Well, under the Region Admission Index, students are rewarded with points for taking more core courses. And one of the reasons I think that these new requirements have been received so favorably among the high schools around the state is because now the counselors and the teachers and the faculty, they have leverage when they tell students that you really do need to take that fourth year of Spanish or you mm-hmm. really should take that fourth year of math.
So do we know that this is being effective, that students are not cruising as much, basically sitting out their senior years?
Yeah, and I'm going to let Phil chat a little bit about implementation. You had mentioned that it's been around for 3 years, but Phil, first year of implementation was?
2008.
Okay.
So we don't have a lot of data, basically. Mm-hmm.
Actually, we implemented it in 2008, but the first class who entered the university under these new requirements entered fall of 2009. So it still is kind of in its infancy stage.
And Phil, you and your colleagues that were on – Phil was part of a committee that looked at – spent almost a year, I think, developing yeah. the RAI, looking at the data, coming up with a system that we felt would be beneficial to everyone, particularly the students. There's going to be quite a bit of research done on the effectiveness of the RAI, correct? Yeah.
If yeah. I'm a parent of a high school student, junior high student, or a high school student listening to this program, and I want to find out more about the RAI, how I can better suit my future high school years to this equation, where can I find out information?
Well, you can go to the Board of Regents, the Iowa Board of Regents website, and there's a link there that you can click on to see an online calculator. And so the student or the parent can just plug in their ACT composite score, their class rank, their cumulative grade point average, and then finally the number of years of core courses that they'll complete by the time they graduate. And the calculator will generate their estimated region admission index score. And if that score is 245 or greater, that means the student's automatically admissible to any of the three public universities. If it's not 245, that doesn't necessarily mean they won't be admitted, but it does mean that their application will be evaluated individually.
Okay. Your questions for Mark Harding and Phil Caffrey of ISU's admissions department. Let's go to B in Des Moines. She dialed 1-866-780-9100. Good afternoon, B.
Hi, good afternoon, and it's actually D as in D.
D as, okay,
hi.
We've got a, good.
I have a question. I'm really excited to hear this because I have a homeschool student, and I've been homeschooling my son, and I want to know, he's in sophomore year, and I want to know, how does this new RAI index fit in for a homeschool student? What do I need to do as a homeschool parent homeschooling my child, make sure that he can get into your colleges, because actually we were looking into the Ames program.
Very good question. Thank you, Dee.
Well, I'll take a shot at that. And Dee, the first thing that I need to tell you right up front is that we would not use the RAI score to admit your child. We have a number of homeschooled students who are enrolled at Iowa State, and essentially what we do is we evaluate them individually. The four factors that make up the RAI, a few of those factors are not available for homeschooled students. For example, there is no class rank, and there typically is no GPA, although sometimes homeschool students will take courses through their local school district and receive grades there. But so basically what we do is we just take a look at the student's overall academic record, and we do have to place a little added emphasis on the student's ACT or SAT scores, because that's really the only measure that allows us to compare that student to all the other students. But I think you could say Iowa State is a very homeschool-friendly university. And while we don't have a lot of homeschool students, we do have a fair number, and we have tracked them. And the research shows us that they do well at Iowa State, better than students who enter directly from high school.
So you would see no disadvantage for homeschool students entering any of the major universities in Iowa?
No, I don't think so. It's just really important, though, that as a parent, you try to document as much as you can the subjects that your son or daughter is studying, and you know, keep track of the name of the textbooks that you use, and hold on to the syllabus that you use, and things like that, because that will help us determine whether we believe the student meets all of our high school course requirements and things like that.
Dee, did that give you a good enough answer?
Yeah, that's great. That's exactly what I wanted to know. But one last question. He said high school course requirements. Would that be the same thing for the Des Moines Area Public School? If I'm following that, would that meet that, or would I need to go into your website to pull that?
Well, you can see all three of the state universities' minimum high school course requirements on their website. But at Iowa State, I'll just tell you very quickly, all students, when they enter the university, are expected to have completed 4 years of English in high school, three years of math, including 1 year each of algebra, geometry, and advanced algebra, three years of science, including 1 year each of two of the following, biology, chemistry, or physics.
I'm trying to write as you speak. Biology, chemistry, and physics?
Yes, you need two of those three.
Okay.
And 3 years of science total.
Okay.
And then I'd recommend at minimum 3 years of social studies.
Okay.
And 2 years of a single foreign language.
And 2 years of a single foreign language.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Sounds like we're on the course.
And I'd encourage you to go out to the website, and you'll see a really nicely laid out grid for all three.
Definitely we'll be doing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The website. Okay. Thank you, Dee. The website once again?
Well, Iowa State's website is www.iastate.edu.
Okay, and at any of the public university websites, just look for the admissions section. Let's talk a little bit about standardized tests, since we did use that as the way to get into this conversation today, talking about ACT's 50 years of existence. How, in this new RAI system, Are standardized tests like ACT more or less important?
Well, Phil and I are staring at each other, wondering how best to respond to that. Phil mentioned earlier, I'll start, maybe Phil can follow. I don't think they're any more or less important. They're a factor. And I think I caught just a little bit of the interview earlier, and I think the president of ACT, Dick Ferguson, was mentioning this. It's a factor. It's something we can use. I mean, the nice thing about an assessment test is whether you take it in Des Moines or Minnesota or you know, Eastern Iowa, Western Iowa, it's the same assessment. We look at it as a tool. I think most admissions offices look at the ACT as a tool. Mm-hmm. The nice thing about the RAI is that there are a number of factors that we can consider. I think in my experience, between Phil and I think we have about 55, 60 years of admissions experience. You know, there's some correlation between that darn ACT or the SAT, but there's some correlation between the test score and the student's ability, with loads and loads of exceptions.
Mm-hmm. What do you have to watch out for when you look at a very high ACT or SAT score? What are the red flags you might be looking at so that you don't get someone who tests very well on one of these standardized tests, but that's not absolutely an accurate reflection of how they are academically?
Yeah, that's a great point. We see instances of students who have very high standardized test scores, but yet their grade point average and their class rank doesn't really match what that test score is. And it kind of shows that on a day-to-day basis in the classroom, the student isn't really performing up to their abilities. And that's a real red flag. Conversely, we'll see students that don't have very strong test scores, but yet they have a very high GPA and a very strong class rank. And that just shows us that for whatever reason, you know, the student does not perform well on those standardized exams, but their work ethic, you know, their priorities, they all seem to be right where they need to be.
Mm-hmm. How do you view in admissions the difference between the ACT and the SAT?
We accept either one.
But in their character, what they're measuring, how would you characterize the SAT compared to the ACT in its character, in what it measures?
Well, you know, I'm a little biased because I work at Iowa State, and the vast majority of test scores we receive are ACT and not SAT, and so I'm a little partial to ACT. The ACT is made up of four tests versus the SAT being made up essentially of two tests, and so I feel like we get a little better picture of overall picture of the student through those test scores, but they both essentially do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And they're both very, very helpful in predicting the success of students at Iowa State.
Isn't it true that if we would look at the people who take ACTs compared to SATs and put them out on a big map of the United States and maybe color-coded it, that the SAT would be, what, on the coasts and the ACT in the middle section?
Pretty much. I've had the privilege of working in public higher education in Massachusetts, Virginia, Florida, and now here in Iowa for the past 13 years. And it does. It varies by state. There are SAT states, there are ACT states, and then there are states that are sort of split right down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And in my experience, again, as Phil said, they're both, marvelous tools that are a part of what admissions offices utilize to determine a student's ability to be successful at a particular college.
Very quickly, not much time left, less than a minute. The Regents universities have some pretty lofty goals with regards to minority recruitment. Any thought on how the test bias may impact their ability to admit or recruit minority students? 30 seconds for that.
Well, it's difficult to comment in 30 seconds. I hope that ACT and SAT continue doing the good work that they're doing to try to expand access and to continue to tweak the tool that they have to make it as fair as possible as an effective tool for us.
Mm-hmm.
All.
What would be the biggest tweak on your list they need to address?
Oh, I don't have a tweak list.
You don't have a tweak list.
I don't have a tweak list. No. And
well,
remember, because it's just one of many tools we use, it's we'll just continue to work with them to make sure it's doing what it's intended to do.
Okay, thank you very much. Mark Harding, Director of Admissions at ISU. Phil Caffrey, Senior Associate Director of Admissions at ISU. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming into the studio today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
We unfortunately need to end our show today with some very sad news. Greg Shanley, the host of Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio, passed away last night. Greg joined KUNI in 1987 and served for many years as the station's Morning Edition host and news director. After the creation of Iowa Public Radio, he was a leading force in developing the statewide talk shows, first as the producer of The Exchange, and then as the host of Talk at 12 and Talk of Iowa. Listeners will miss his easygoing style and his ability to have a conversation about anything with anyone. We, his co-workers, will miss his dedication to the craft of radio and his friendship. Our thoughts and prayers are with his wife, Sonia, daughter, Leah, son, Evan, and daughter-in-law, Angie, and his grandson, Titan. Greg Shanley died last night. He was 49 years old.